This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
So our next speaker is Dr. Jane Tobias, who is an associate professor at Thomas Jefferson University's Jefferson College of Nursing and a pediatric nurse practitioner with more than 20 years of experience in pediatric primary care at the Jefferson Center for Autism and Neurodiversity. She is the Golisano Fellow in Developmental Disability Nursing and directs the fellowship program at the Golisano Institute for Developmental Disability Nursing. Her academic career is dedicated to improving health outcomes for neurodiverse children and youth with developmental disabilities through graduate nursing education, interprofessional collaboration, and advancing clinical training in developmental disability care. Dr. Tobias is an active member of the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners. She is committed to advancing equitable, compassionate, and developmentally informed nursing care for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families. Please welcome Dr. Tobias, who will inform us about addressing environmental health for children and adolescents with disabilities.
Thank you, Dr. Takayama, for that introduction. And good morning, everybody. I am grateful and I am honored to be speaking with you today on an issue for me that really sits at the intersection of what I do, pediatrics, disability, and looking at the environment and how we as providers can kind of push the limit on environmental justice. So children and adolescents with disabilities are not just more affected by environmental hazards. What we found is that they are more systematically and disproportionately affected both biologically and socially by these hazards. And throughout the next half hour, we're going to explore what some of those hazards are. But really, we have 30 minutes to just scratch the surface on something that's so important that is kind of newer to the educational curriculum. As a faculty member, I have just started in the past several years talking about the impact of environmental health. And I think most importantly, we know that these environmental exposures are not simply background factors anymore in children's lives, that they can directly shape and impact the developmental trajectories of many of our children. They impact participation in daily activities, educational progress, those long-term health outcomes and goals for our children and adolescents that are living with disabilities, both physical, cognitive, and emotional. Quickly, I have no disclosures, no financial relationship with any organizations that would influence the content of this presentation. So during our time together, we're going to focus on four areas here. We're going to look at the environmental health risks for children and adolescents with disabilities and why these children experience greater impact and vulnerabilities as a result of them. We'll look at some policies and provider responsibilities. And when I say provider, I want us to think about that interprofessional team and those that we collaborate with, because we know the work that we do is never done in a silo, that we have so many partners, including parents as partners across our health systems. And lastly, hopefully I'll impart on you some practical tools and resources that you can integrate into the care you deliver when you leave this conference today or when you are back in the office Monday morning. So I always like to start my presentations with what is your why? Sometimes in the busyness of a day, we forget what really is our why, what brought us to the work that we do. So I invite you to reflect on what brought you to this conference today, to this presentation. And for many of us, it's that recognition that children with disabilities are often overlooked, particularly when it comes to environmental health conversations, despite carrying the highest burden of exposure and the least control over their environments. So who are these children and adolescents that we're talking about? We know that children and adolescents face disabilities and they have a double challenge in doing so. They not only are working through the medical complexity of their diagnosis, whether it is a medical, a physical, a developmental need, but then they are also working through the additional strain of environmental threats. The common ones we think of, right? Air pollutants, allergens, unsafe housing. But I want you to expand your thought a little bit when we think of the environment. I want you to go into what we call the built environment, right? That is where our children and adolescents live, play, pray. It's where they do their work every day, that physical structure of the built environment, but also the less physical structure. Where are they living? Are they living in a high flood area or a coastal area? Are they living in an area that sees a high incidence of wildfire, where that air pollutants, that air quality is always at a poor level? Are they living near factories or a train depot? And something that has come onto the horizon with our advanced technology is something called e-pollution. And that is, how are we now disposing of technology? And what does that look like for soil, for our environment, when we think of how we are getting rid of computers and electronics? We know that these environmental stressors can really derail developmental progress in our kids or intensify existing conditions when we think of their ability for emotional regulation, and particularly in those children that have neurodevelopmental and genetic disorders. These kids often experience higher exposure to environmental hazards based on where they have to live. They have greater physiologic susceptibility to these exposures, and they have lower ability to be able to avoid or remove themselves from unsafe environments. They're at the mercy of us, of the adults, to do that for them. We also know that these kids have a greater likelihood of living in under-resourced housing or neighborhoods, and we'll touch on that shortly, and that there's often barriers in receiving timely environmental assessments. Sometimes no environmental assessment because we only have so many minutes in a visit, and there's so many other topics which are priorities in their care that we don't often ask about where they live or what's changed in their environment. And because of these overlapping vulnerabilities, it means that environmental health can no longer be a separate topic when we're speaking with families. It really has to become core to developmental health, to functional abilities of these kids, and also to disability equity. So this is a slide from the 2023 National Survey of Child's Health. And what we're seeing is, what is the prevalence and what are those special health care needs? Conditions like asthma, ADHD, autism, developmental delay make up a significant portion of pediatric disability, right? And a lot of times they're often what we call those invisible disabilities. They're not outwardly showing. Many of these kids are typical in their physical presentation. But how we frame this matters because each of these conditions can be and will be deeply affected by those environmental detriments, from air quality to toxic exposure, and then to climate-related stressors. And that includes when natural disasters happen, right? When we have wildfires, when we have floods, how that disrupts their routine, how that disrupts where they live. Does it increase their attendance in an ER? Are they being seen for more visits, which in turn means they're not getting to therapy, they're not getting to school, and they're losing out on those areas. So differences in children and teens with disabilities do make a difference. And, I'm an educator. When I meet my nurse practitioners for the first semester, my family nurse practitioners, you can't help but say, particularly my FNP students, kids are just not smaller versions of adults. But we take it one step further when we're working with children from disabilities. And that is, they have so much more that we need to unpack and think about. So generally, children, their respiratory, their neurologic, their immune, their endocrine systems, they're still developing. We know that. We know that they breathe more air per body weight, that they have more hand-to-mouth behaviors. They spend the first couple years on the ground, very oral in their development. Children with motor or sensory impairments may be unable to move away or to avoid those hazards. And as I just said, they don't have that ability to advocate for themselves, asking to be removed from a certain situation. Children with Down syndrome have hypotonia. They have airway differences that worsen the effects of allergens, of mold, and of particulate matter in the air. Do we think about that when we're seeing them for a visit for multiple URIs? Do we think to ask, where are you living? Or what's changed in the environment around you that could be impacting why I am seeing you so much for these URIs? Children with autism and with sensory processing disorders, we know have a difficult time with emotional regulation. Couple that with chemical smells, with ozone pollution, with noise pollution, where are they living and how that can really impact their behaviors over time, particularly if there's been a change in that environment around them. Children with asthma, with congenital heart disease, chronic lung disease, I think of my preemies, those with BPD, are dramatically more sensitive to those traffic-related air pollution, wildfires, smoke. I'm on the East Coast. I know the West Coast folks, you see that all the time. We see it a lot here in the New Jersey area, particularly during the summertime with red flag alerts. I have a point where I can communicate that to my families I know that live in those high-risk areas. So part of it is really getting to know the community in which you're practicing in and what it can be at higher risk for, and then how do we set up systems within our practices to alert our high-risk children and their families that this may occurring. And then lastly, those children with neuromuscular conditions that may have limited cough strength in getting rid of excess mucus, particularly if they also are coupled with asthma. They are more susceptible because of the respiratory effects of pollutants to increased ER visits and increased asthma. So what I want you to think about is that environmental hazards don't just cause symptoms, right? They interfere with so much more. They interfere with the sleep, with the concentration of kids, with physiologic stability, and with their ability to regulate behavior and emotion. And at the end of the day, all of these have a profound effect on that developmental progress, particularly those first 6 years of life. We see it greatly impacted where all of a sudden they will plateau. And we're not sure, is the plateau related to their underlying condition, or is the plateau related to something extraneous that's going on in the environment around them? So it's important to be curious and to ask those questions. This is a slide that UNICEF put out 2024, and I love it because it's, first of all, I'm very visual, so it's easy to look at, it's easy to break down the systems, and it really lets you know how some of these invisible threats that we actually don't see can impact the growing body of a child. So environmental exposures like lead, particulate matter, those endocrine disrupting chemicals, and I think the one we all think about is BPA, bisphenol A, that we find in plastic food containers, certain medical tubing, may still contain it, depending on what part of the country, if it's a rural area. And also, we know that they lend themselves to hyperactivity in kids, to attention problems, and to a higher increase in that emotional dysregulation. In essence, these chemicals don't simply trigger symptoms. They shape the trajectory of a developing brain and a developing body by repeated exposure. So for a child that has existing disability, these effects can be multiplicative. They can widen that developmental gap and actually increase their healthcare needs. And when there's an increase in needs, we often know that sometimes other things go by the wayside when these priorities show themselves. So where is the exposure coming from for children? This is kind of a busy slide, but just to break it down pretty simply, that children and teenagers encounter these exposures through breathing, through eating and drinking. What's absorbed through their skin? And what I mean by that is we don't often ask a parent where they work, what do they do for a job? Could they be bringing anything home on themselves that could be transferred to their child through the skin? And we know They explore their world very orally, particularly the younger kids. For children with disabilities, factors such as feeding difficulties, pica, reduced mobility, the use of assistive equipment can greatly increase or alter the pathway of exposure for them. So I want to take a moment and introduce Eli to you. Eli is 3 years old. He has a diagnosis of Down syndrome. He had a repaired AV canal as an infant, and he also has hypotonia. Eli lives in an urban apartment that already shows mold, pest residue, peeling paint, and he lives by the side of a highway. So there is heavy traffic exposure there. When I see Eli, he's coming into the office frequently with URI infections. He has eczema, I would say moderate to severe eczema, significant developmental delay, particularly in the area of communication and poor weight gain. And he is often not sleeping well as a result of some mild obstructive sleep apnea, but also as a result of the heavy traffic noise where he lives. So Eli lives with his mom, who's a single mom and has two siblings. They live in a neighborhood that's classified as an environmental justice zone. So what does that mean? It's kind of the intersection of vulnerable populations and where they live in high-risk environments and exposures. So a lot of times we think about those urban areas, right? Where there's housing projects, where there's a lot of factories, where there could be a lot of highway and airway pollution. Eli's family receives SNAP benefits. As I said, he's living in subsidized housing. Both these are indicators of increased environmental risk. And this is not because Eli's family made poor choices. This is a result of their lived experience. This is where they have to live, where they have to navigate from. Most affordable housing is older housing, and older housing is not always maintained. So we want to ask where they're living and how old it is. We know that there are environmental hazard clusters in these under-resourced communities. We want to find out what they are. Your Department of Health and the community in which you live is a great help with that in pointing out these higher risk hazards. That families of children with disabilities often face higher financial pressure, and that navigating where to find healthy living, where to find, and I'm referring to that built environment, that area that has green spaces, that area that has updated water filtration systems, updated electric, updated air filtration systems can be difficult for a caregiver to find these areas because their priorities are on their child with a disability, on attending to work, on other children in the household. They have so many competing priorities that they often need help with this. So what are some of these environmental influences in Eli's life and how do they impact him? It impacts them on multiple levels, right? On the physical level, housing, pollution, noise. When we think of chemicals, we want to think of, is he living near factories? Is there a concern for lead or pesticides? Some of those biologic influences, such as mold, allergens. In Eli's case, he has both cockroach and mice residue that exist in his home. And then the social aspect. And I think this is really impactful, not only when we think of our children, but when we think of their caregivers. Do they have access to other adults that they can talk to, that they can relieve some of this stress and have an outlet for it? Are the neighborhoods where they live safe enough where they can take their child outside and not be concerned about injury? Is there an area for green space? There's been a lot of research done in biophilia of green spaces and how that can be positive in development. So, when we look at these four domains, we know that they have a cumulative burden for many families, and that many families are unable to get out from under these areas because of financial restrictions and housing restrictions. So let's just take a moment to look at some environmental exposures and the effect on health. And this came out of the EPA, the CDC, and the American Lung Association report that was just published. And what it tells us is air pollution, as we see here, has the highest impact again, followed by mold and pesticides and noise. And, noise is something we don't often think about as an environmental hazard, but constant noise, constant humming in a child that has a neurodevelopmental disability, such as autism or IDD, can really be impactful in their ability to regulate. Even mild exposures can cause larger than expected functional impact on their day-to-day development. So there's also a disproportionate exposure in children with disabilities to the impact of environmental hazards. Children with disabilities experience higher rates of displacement when an environmental event occurs, such as flooding, such as wildfires. They end up in the emergency room quite frequently with caregivers that don't know their background, that are already overwhelmed by an influx of patients, and they have poorer recovery times after the result of that environmental disruption. For an example, when we think of wildfires, when we think of poor air quality, we often see an increase in bronchitis, an increase in asthma symptoms. And these kids take quite a bit longer to recover from that. Heat waves and pollution spikes can really affect and harm children that have neurologic vulnerabilities. I think of my kids that have spinal cord injuries and their inability to thermoregulate. And if we're in the midst of a heat wave, if they live in housing that does not have air conditioning or they can't afford it, and they're dependent on fans, but yet their windows only open 4 inches, it's kind of the perfect storm for these kids to get into trouble and end up back in the ER or end up missing days of schools, missing therapy time. So again, it's important when we see them in the office to always be curious and ask these questions. Now, here are some of the more common physical health impact on our kids with disabilities. So for children with disabilities, respiratory exposure to mold, to dust, to that indoor smoke can lead to an increase in ER visits and hospitalizations, an increase in missed therapy in school days, slower developmental progress or a plateau in their developmental progress, an increase in fatigue. And that increase in fatigue can snowball and lead to decreased participation in activities such as their therapy, which then has the trickle-down effect to a slower developmental progression for them. And lastly, there's a higher risk of airway complication. I think of my children with Down syndrome who already have an increased prevalence for sleep apnea. And then you couple that with mold, with smoke, and with pest residue, and that airway obstruction can worsen significantly and really put them at higher risk for problems. When I think of my neurodevelopmental kids, we know environmental toxins like lead, which is an obvious one, pesticides and traffic pollutants can impair executive function. It can impair working memory and learning. For a child who already has a cognitive or developmental disability, what happens is these exposures widen that developmental gap, right? And they have a much harder time catching up. It can couple a delay in acquisition of language, motor, or adaptive skills. When I think of my older kids with an intellectual or developmental disability who are working really hard with those adaptive skills, and they end up having overexposure to pollutants which impact them, it takes them longer to get to those skills. Behavioral and emotional dysregulation. Oftentimes, we will think that that dysregulation is a result of what their underlying diagnosis is, right? Diagnostic overshadowing can occur in these events where we say there must be a worsening of their seizures or something else may be occurring directly related to that diagnosis. I'm not real good. I've gotten better at asking the next question. Has anything changed in the environment? Has anything changed in your home? What is going on around you that could be increasing this dysregulation? Maybe it has nothing to do with their underlying diagnosis. Maybe it has everything to do with where they're living, where they're attending school at that moment. And that is something, if we identify it, we can intervene. And then what happens is it also increases the need for more support. And we know when more support is needed, as I said earlier, other things go by the wayside. So these environmental exposures can really change the slope of developmental growth curves for kids like this. And then when we think about physical activity, when we think about injury risk, I go to green spaces. I go to where these kids are able to move around, right? Not be so sedentary and actually be outside enjoying other children socializing more. A lot of these kids may live in areas where there's poor housing, there's broken stairs, there's exposed wiring. Perhaps the neighborhood is just not safe for them to be in because of accidental injury. So again, it's important to do that environmental survey at well visits, update it periodically, so we again can see where we can intervene as providers and such. Now let's take a little time to look at some of the mental impacts. Children with disabilities already have difficulty navigating some of the sensory, the cognitive, and social challenges. Coupled with some of these environmental exposures, what happens is it acutely increases their risk of anxiety and depression. We start to see more behavioral and cognitive challenges, also, an increase in those externalizing behaviors, such as aggression, hyperactivity, self-injurious behaviors as a result of this. Trauma and stress, toxic stress, I always put into the bucket of an environmental hazard. We know that every time we see a family, those families walk through our door with medical trauma, with trauma of their own. And they may not tell you about it, but we know that they carry it. And then they're placed in an environment that may have overcrowded housing, that might be a high crime area, that just adds to that stress. And this can further social isolation for them, social isolation for their children as well. So, again, there is a huge trickle down effect when we don't think of the environment and we don't ask questions on a team basis. So, what is our role in environmental health? And it's just not the healthcare provider role, it's our interprofessional team role. How can we be an advocate? How can we impact? So, we want to educate. And education for me, in my role as a primary care pediatric nurse practitioner, begins at that newborn visit, right? That's the first time I will begin any education. But the families, we're meeting them at the time when they may be receiving a diagnosis that is devastating them. We're meeting them at a time we're talking about air pollution. Really, they're not hearing it. It's not a priority. So I encourage you, every time you have that opportunity, just to impart something in terms of the environment and how to be healthier about it, or to ask a question. Be curious, as I said earlier. If there is an acute change in a child's either physical development, emotional development, and their behavior, we need to get to the root of it. And getting to the root of it is doing that very comprehensive medical assessment, social assessment, but also asking about the environment and what has changed in the environment. Part of our anticipatory guidance in my pediatric role, this is my bread and butter. Every visit, I am giving anticipatory guidance, what to think about next, what to look for in that moment. And we can easily fold the environment into this and add some education for them. Be alert to changes that are occurring in the community and always be alert to the vulnerability of our population of children and adolescents that we work with, and the vulnerability of their caregivers. Because if we don't take that into consideration, if we don't take the caregiver's health into consideration, then we're really going to have trouble getting the needs of that child met. So I always look at them as a dyad or a triad. Every time I ask a question about the child or the teenager, I'm asking the same question about that parent or that caregiver. So let's take a moment now to get into the nuts and bolts of this. This screening, the mnemonic is called I Prepare. This is something that I came across several years ago, and it's a screening tool that I really like. And why do I like it? As you can see, it only takes 60 seconds to go. iPrepare has been around since 2005, so it's old, but it is comprehensive. And it's near and dear to my heart because it was developed by nurses. Now, this is not the only environmental screening tool out there, but this is the one I tend to go to because I have a lot of ground I need to cover in a 20-minute well visit. And as you can see here, you're able to move through it pretty easily. So let's take a look at it. Investigate exposures, right? Smoke, mold, pest, lead. What's your water source? I don't know about you, but when I'm sitting there meeting with a family and I ask them about what's the water source in your apartment, like, tell me about any mold or pest residue, they have no idea, right? They may say, well, we do have mice droppings. So I find an easier strategy is to have them just, I say, close your eyes, open the door to your apartment or to your home, and describe to me with your eyes closed what you're seeing. And when they start describing it in that manner, then I have a visual and I can jump in and say, okay, tell me about those windows. Are you able to open or close them? Do you feel drafts coming through them? Do you have screens? Do those windows, what are they facing? Are they facing a green space like a park? Or are they facing a train depot? Are they facing a highway where there's a lot of air pollution and noise coming through? So we want to investigate those exposures. And I find doing it this way gives me a lot of information. I also will go to the health department and ask about the community in which they live in and what are some things I need to think about. What has been reported recently? Is there an uptick in high lead levels in that area? What is the water source? The P is where are they present every day? Where do they work? Where do they go to school? This is both for the child, the teenager, and the parent. What do they do for a job? Is their apartment building undergoing renovations? Are they repainting it where we have a concern about paint chips falling into the soil, which may have lead and gets tracked into the home? And then we have our very oral child that has their hands in their mouth, and we know that's the transmission of lead, and that's how high lead levels can occur. What is the residence in which they live? What year was it built? What's the water system like? And again, I will often go to the health department for this information because a lot of folks don't know. They have no idea what year their home was built in or their housing, when was it built? Are there environmental concerns that are specific to the area in which you're practicing? Geographically, do you live near a coastal waterway that may have a high incidence of waterborne bacteria at certain times of the year? Do you live in a flood zone? Do you live in an area that's at high risk for wildfires? So again, getting to know that area where you live is really helpful in mitigating some of these things. And then also, is there any past medical information I need to know about? What activities does this child participate in? What education has occurred? So let's take this one step further and let's look at our buddy Eli and think about Eli. We know already that he has Down syndrome, that he's prone to URIs, that the family lives in urban housing. When we apply the iPrepare, what we find out in terms of investigating is that there's smoke, mold, lead, and water risk. Their filtration system is old. Where are they present? He goes to school all day. He takes the bus. They live in housing. We found out it's very old housing. In terms of the environment, he's at high risk for poor air quality, for smoke, and for climate, disasters that can occur quite frequently, such as earthquakes. And then again, activities and those education. Well, the health department I learned was already at Eli's house for some lead mitigation, but they haven't returned. So I need to do a follow-up call to the health department and find out why they haven't returned them back out there again. So these are some tools and resources I just mentioned with you. Several different environmental health checklists that you can use. There's different referral networks out there for housing, for public health, and for education. There is something called the Regional Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Unit. And when you Google that and when you look for it, you'll see regional areas. I live in Philadelphia. I have the Mid-Atlantic Center for Children's Health and Environment. These little networks are great resources, particularly for educational materials. And then the American Pediatrics has a lot of statements that are already out there about pediatric health, air pollution, lead toxicity, climate change, and also food additives, which is something I didn't talk a lot about, but that is another presentation for you. So, in advocating for Eli, we want to make sure that we cover several areas. We want to look at those environmental risks. We want to make sure we're monitoring ongoing developmental tracking and that he's getting his health screenings met, and that we're also being that advocate, right? That advocate when it comes to environmental justice, safe housing, and school collaboration for him. And then at the end of the day, just some key takeaways to summarize for you to think about that children with disabilities do experience higher vulnerability, higher exposures, and more severe health impacts. That healthcare providers, all providers of children, can meaningfully intervene through screening, through guidance, and through advocacy. Interprofessional teams and collaboration are essential in this work if we're going to make a difference. And that environmental health is foundational to developmental health. Improving environmental conditions is developmental support, and we need to start thinking of it that way. Safe housing, clean air, reduced toxic exposure are as medically necessary as therapy and medication. And by integrating environmental assessments into our work every day, using advocacy in our routine care, we are honoring both the child's developmental potential and also recognizing that family's lived experience. So that concludes my presentation. It was a lot in 30 minutes, but I thank you so much for your attention. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them for you.
Thank you so much for delineating the range of factors that make children, youth, and adults with developmental disabilities more likely to be impacted by environmental hazards. And so it really feels like you have to go back into the environment to make changes. And that's not something that is easy to do. Partners, and I've heard about medical legal partnerships. It sounds like the health department can play a role, and I'm wondering if you have any like best practices, organizations that you particularly like. I know you mentioned them in one of your slides, but in Philadelphia.
I will tell you, believe it or not, and it's still up on their website, the EPA does have a lot of great resources for healthcare providers out there to use and to build into your anticipatory guidance. What I started to do is I got, the area I live in, I've lived here a very long time. I know it well. So when I do my visits, I use Epic. I'm able to create smart phrases, and I just start building out some educational stuff that I can automatically put into after visit summaries if I don't have a chance to talk about it during that visit, because our visits, there's a lot to go over. The Regional Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Unit, has regional areas nationally. So if you look that up, you can find out who is in your area, and they are also a great partner. For myself, in the Pennsylvania area, the Mid-Atlantic area, we have the Mid-Atlantic Center for Children's Health and the Environment, and that's who I can turn to for resources and to also be a support. And then grassroots, I've gotten to know my local representatives. And I've developed that 2-minute elevator speech about certain things that really concern me. And I'll just send them an email. I'll pick up the phone and call them. And, as you said, Dr. Takayama, that we can't change the environment singularly, but we can kind of start to pick away at it. And we can start with small changes and just getting to know some of the local folks in your community first and gather allies and get that momentum going.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm wondering if you might be able to answer some of the specific questions offline.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, everybody.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.